The Scrabble Go Guide to Learning New Words. Quizzical, your dad's face when he hasn't got enough vowels. Skeptical, your mom's face when you try to say small is a word. Belligerent, how your brother feels when he doesn't win. Vocabulary, what you all build when you play Scrabble Go together. Everyone's a winner with Scrabble Go, the fun brain training game you can play with family wherever you are. Available on Android and iOS. Download Scrabble Go today.
It's the Ginny Show Daily Edition for this Saturday. One of my favorite things to do on a Saturday is to go out for brunch. It's a ritual to share this brunch after a lovely sleep in with friends and loved ones. The brunches I usually have involve sharing what we've been up to for the week, what's come up for us in our spiritual learning, and what we can do to use this as a tool in our life. It just takes one conversation to change the course of your day, your month, your year, and your life. My first Saturday brunch is with fellow podcaster and filmmaker Alex Ferrari. He has a top rating podcast on iTunes for filmmakers called Indie Film Hustle. His current project, On the Corner of Ego and Desire, was shot completely at the Sundance Film Festival. What I loved learning about Alex was his spiritual practice. He meditates for hours a day, and I learned that he has such a natural way of surrendering his ego. So, let's have brunch with Alex Ferrari.
So, Mr. Alex Ferrari, you're a renowned independent filmmaker. You're also an awesome podcast host. Tell me, where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in two places. I was born in Florida, and I stayed there for about 2.5 years down in the Fort Lauderdale area, next to Miami. Then I was whisked away to New York, and I spent the next 7 years growing up in Queens, and Jamaica, Queens, to be exact. And I lived there until I was 10. Then I came back to Florida for the next, X amount of years. And then I finally came out here 10 years ago to L.A. And I've been here ever since and don't plan on leaving anytime in the near future.
Wow. So you're from the East Coast. You're an East Coast boy. What on earth made you move to the West?
Well, what do you think? Hollywood, baby, Hollywood.
Fantastic. Okay, so you moved to the West and, you know, obviously Hollywood and filmmaking sparked your interest. So when did this passion start for filmmaking?
The very first time I ever thought about being in the movie business was 1982, where my mother dragged me to see a movie called E.T., and at that point, I didn't even want to see it. It was my birthday and I did not want to see it. And she's like, no, you're going to love it. And I'm like, what is that? The poster was horrible. I didn't even know what it was. And I came out of that movie in awe. And I went home and I started writing a script. Whatever script a 10-year-old could write without any information about how to write a script. So I basically started writing down the story of E.T. And that was the very first time I could remember ever being interested in the business. But you have to remember back in the 80s, the information about making movies was just not out there, not nearly as much as it is today. It wasn't even considered a career, really. It was just this thing. Now everybody, I have teenagers like, oh, I've already directed 4 features. I'm like, you know what? Go F yourself. God damn it. because I did not have those opportunities growing up. But what really, when it really came to fruition was, at 14, I actually got a job at a video store, a mom and pop video store in Fort Lauderdale. And, I loved it. I loved it. I worked there for about 5 years. So a little bit before high school and throughout all my high school. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. I watched movies constantly and it was my film school. And that's where I fell in love with cinema and films and directing and all that stuff. And when I turned 18, I looked around my room and I saw 3,000 VHSs. back then. I can explain what a VHS is if, to your audience if you like.
I know what a VHS is.
Okay, good. So I had 3,000 VHSs around my room, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to be a director. And from that moment on, I just kind of had the dream. I was like, I'm going to go direct. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Obviously, parents being parents kind of have objections to their children doing creative parts. How did your parents react to this?
My parents, my mom was very supportive. So she's like, all right, let's go. And she sent me to film school right away and never thought twice about it. My father, on the other hand, I think he barely still understands what I do now.
Do you have to explain to him all the time what you do?
I do. I think once I had him, I was shooting a commercial in Miami and I invited him to the set. And he was extremely impressed that everybody was doing what I told them to. That was he's like the boss. He like runs things. This is amazing. So it is. I mean, my father is a very, my father is a very simple guy. He worked in the in a factory most of his life. And, came from Cuba, has an amazing story of how he came from Cuba to the States back in the 50s through Castro and all that kind of stuff. And this is just so outside of his world. It is beyond, I think, a lot of things that he can even comprehend. But he does understand somewhat, but still I don't think completely understands the job just yet.
Was there ever a part of you that wanted him to understand? Did you want him to kind of see how well you were doing and kind of, in a sense, I guess, want his kind of seal of approval?
Yeah, I think in general, though, that most my feelings about getting approval from people is sometimes certain people are just not capable of giving you what you want. And the sooner you understand and come to grips with that, the happier both of you will be.
Yeah.
Because it took me many, 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 many years to wrestle with that, where I wanted certain things from my parents, certain things from people that I knew, and they're just not capable of it. It's like asking, a cheetah to live in the North Pole. Like, it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
It's not what they're made of. It's not what they're capable of doing. And once that gem fell into my head of information, and I was like, oh, okay, so this is never going to happen the way I want it to, then I was happy. So with my father, I know he's extremely proud of me, and I know he's extremely proud of what I've done. He obviously sees that I make a living. He obviously sees that I'm able to, raise a family, put food on the table, and have been doing so for over 20-odd years now. He sees that. So whether he understands it or not, he does approve, if you will, of my ability to do what I do, whether he understands it completely. And that's fair because if, one of my kids grows up to be a rocket scientist, I probably won't understand the inner workings of what they do. But I'll, it's that far away from where he is and where he comes from. Is like me being a rocket scientist. It's very similar. Like, he'd be like, I don't know, you send rockets somewhere? It's like he doesn't understand. So, but once I realized that, everything became much easier between my father and I. And he's extremely happy with what I do, and extremely thrilled. And anytime he can see a celebrity, he freaks out. He's such a celebrity hound. It's not even funny.
How do you kind of, explain to him? Like, you obviously live in Hollywood. You probably work with a lot of celebrities yourself and come into contact with people with great influence. How does he kind of, see you as a celebrity wrangler?
No, not at all. I literally took him to my wife actually took him. I wasn't available. My wife actually took him to Forest Lawns here in Los Angeles, which is like where all the celebrities, dead celebrities, are buried. So he was tickled pink. He was just like, oh my God, there's that guy. And look, there's Humphrey Bogart. And look, there's Marilyn Monroe. And he's taking pictures with gravestones. I'm like, Dad, what's wrong with you? Like, you're crazy. But he loved it. And for him, I think the TV and the movies is a magical thing, especially from the era that he grew up in. where those stars like John Wayne and Clint Eastwood and those kind of guys, he looked at as like, you know, what they were, movie stars, these giant monoliths of that they were, legends. And so I guess even being close to their graves means something.
Absolutely. It looks like it does.
Yeah. It's fascinating. My wife and I just look at him like, I don't understand. But he was happy. So, hey, we'll make him happy.
Alex, one thing that I have noticed about you, obviously speaking to you a couple times and hearing a few of the podcasts that you've been on to talk about your story, you're a great storyteller. So that's no coincidence because, you know, you have a screenwriter's podcast and you are well versed in that. Who taught you how to storytell? Like, what inspired you other than E.T.? When did you kind of learn to build this narrative?
I have been, I hate to say, kind of a little bit of it was kind of programmed at the factory. When I came out, I was telling stories and marketing. Like I was telling stories and marketing. When I say marketing, I was telling stories to market. And when I say market, it's like, you know, trying to convince a girl to go out with me. I would literally market to all her friends, her family, her mother, her father, her brother, her sister, you know, whatever, to kind of influence her to finally just go, oh, just give this guy a shot. You know, he's so sweet. Oh my God. So, but that was completely instinctual. No one ever taught it to me. No one ever sat me down and said, hey, this is how you tell a story. This is how you, you know, influence people. It is something that I was born with, and it is I only became aware of it probably only within the last 10 years, honestly. I always just took it so for granted till my wife started pointing it out to me, where she was like, you know, you have this skill. I'm like, I do? And she's like, yeah, look what you've done, you know, with my first short films and how I marketed them and then how I tell the narrative, the story and so forth. So once I understood that I had this power, I started to hone it a little bit more and focus my energy a little bit more, educate myself a little bit more. But it was a skill that I kind of had growing up. It just came programmed from the factory.
Can you give me an example of a marketing pitch that you'd have for a girl to get her to go out with you?
Oh, I could. Oh, of course. So, there's so many. There was this one girl in high school who I had a huge crush on. Her mother, her brother, all of her friends, teachers at the school, all of them were like, why aren't you giving Alex a chance?
Wow.
I mean, it was a complete onslaught. The marketing machine was 24/7 constant. And the girl and I were friends too. It's not like we weren't friends and I was just like a creeper, sir. Those stalking laws were a lot less back then. But then I would like, oh God, is she like the BMWs? Like she liked BMWs, right? So like, oh, why don't I rent a BMW for her, you know, for the day, you know, and like things like that, like the craziest, stupidest things you could imagine. I did. And people, and it never worked, by the way, she was very strong willed. but we were friends and we stayed friends throughout high school, regardless of all of this pressure. That's one story. I have another one from earlier in middle school. I had t-shirts made in sixth grade. I mean,
hey, you go to the effort.
No, I mean, this is like 86. T-shirts aren't easy to get made. I went to the mall, got them made. It was insane. I was an insane person. I really was. Like I said, stalking laws were much looser back then. And thank God there was no social media. I just thank God every day, because there would have been a website, a YouTube channel. There would have been social media accounts. It would have just been – then I think definitely the authorities would have been involved.
That's fascinating. I was going to say, too, I think if I ever need to, you know, propose or do some big production, I'm coming to get some ideas from you, Alex.
I appreciate that.
Obviously, screenwriting was a skill for you, and your wife pointed that out to you. But what made you take that next step and dive in?
Well, screenwriting has always been difficult for me, and I'm by no stretch an expert screenwriter. Screenwriting is a art form that is so in detail and depth and so many nuances. And I have written a handful of screenplays, but it is extremely difficult to write a good one. But I can go back, look over story itself and find things that at least sing to me and make sense to me. What rings true to me as a storyteller, it's just my perspective on it. But I dived in when I started making movies, when I started writing. You know, I think that the narratives and the stories that I kind of put together are at the beginning of my career, more in my early stages, I was trying to impress. So I was trying to create product that I thought people would like and I was trying to hack Hollywood and trying to, like, you know, sneak in through the back door almost. And trying to create product that I'm like, hey, look what I can do kind of stuff. Look how cool I am. Please, someone give me money to make a big movie. And that was the way I approached it. Where now in my life, especially with my last two features, I don't do that anymore. I actually tell stories that I feel passionate about, that I want to say, and I don't really care if anyone else likes them or doesn't like them. Not my audience. I always want to make it for an audience. I want the audience to enjoy it, but I'm not trying to get a producer's eye or get a big agency to look at me or anything like that. It's not what I care about anymore. Don't get me wrong. If Marvel calls, I'm going to take the call. But generally, I'm not trying to do that. I think that only comes with maturity and when you kind of become a little bit more comfortable in your own skin. And that just takes time. It takes time and takes years and patience to be able to do that. So nowadays, these kind of stories, especially my latest film, which is called On the Corner of Ego and Desire, which just got accepted into Rain Dance in the UK, which I'm really, really excited about. That film is as much DNA of mine than anything I've ever done in my entire life. Like, people who know me watch that movie and they go, oh, that is 100% you. Like, this is all you. You are running through every fiber of this film. And that makes me feel good because that's basically an expression of who I am, as opposed to trying to make a movie that's going to go make $1 million or $10 million, $100 million, or try to get the attention of whoever. This film is something that I felt real passionate about, and I did it. And that I think is where my storytelling is going moving forward. More personal stuff at the moment. I have a few more films I want to do that are more personal and hopefully grow from there into bigger budgets, bigger storytelling, bigger set pieces and so on. But as long as the stories stay personal, I think that's where I kind of want to go, at least at this stage of my career.
Alex, one thing that's great about you that you just mentioned there was you kind of have figured out what you were good at. You also seem to have this amazing tenacity of not really caring about what others think when it comes to your project. Did you also learn that? Like, did you learn that from your parents or your surroundings, or did you also come out of the machine wired that way?
No, that took years to do. That's years and decades for me to get to that place. That's just maturity. I did not come out like that. I cared extremely a lot about what other people thought. That's why in the early part of my career, I was trying to impress them much, where now I don't. But that's only probably within the last 5 to 8 years that I finally just came to that understanding of myself and said, you know what? I'm done. I can't care about what other people think. It's exhausting. Let me just do me. And it started in the second I did that, everything started to work out for me. Things started to get better. Doors started opening. Opportunities started presenting themselves that were never there before because I was being me. And I think that is the key to any artist, is to just be true to who you are as a person. You know, if you like horror movies, make a horror movie. If that's something that really you really love doing, great. But if you're making a horror movie and your real dream is to make a drama, and you're doing a horror movie because you think it's going to make money, you're done. You're not going to make it. It's in the long term, you're going to be miserable. And what's the point? You know, what's the point of that? You know, we're all here for a short amount of time. And most of us chase dreams that sometimes aren't healthy for us, where you think that they're, you know, you think you want to be rich and famous. You think you want to make $100 million movie. But there's only a handful of people in the world who can do that, honestly, you know, to actually do it well. And it sometimes might not be the best thing for you, you know, as a human being, as your development, as a, for lack of a better term, a soul on your journey here. You've got to find things that make you happy and are you true to yourself. Those are the biggest things, some of the biggest lessons I've learned over the last few years.
That's amazing. I think when it comes to not caring about what people think, it's obviously a process that you have to develop in it. It's kind of like going to the gym. You have to always, you know, train that muscle. Who was the first, like when you kind of realize, okay, I have to really go my own path and stop caring about what people think, what was the first kind of conscious decision you made when someone said something or an approval that was out there? You're like, nah, I'm just going to keep going. What was that first step?
Well, the very first step was that I was attached to another big project with a big producer and all the trimmings, and started doing castings again and you know, meeting actors and agents and all this kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden the project went away again. And then at that point I turned to myself, I'm like, Alex, you're 40 years old, man. Like, you can't keep doing this. You got to get out of this cycle of this up and down, chasing the carrot that Hollywood kind of threw in front of you, that you're chasing this carrot. And I said, you know what? I'm done. I'm going to go make a movie. I called up my friend Jill, who is a stand-up comic and an actress and an amazingly talented person. I called her up. I was like, hey, I want to make a movie. And we're going to make it about your life as a stand-up female comic and actress in LA, and you don't happen to be 25 anymore. And she's like, I'm in. And she called all her friends who happen to be insanely talented actors from Reno 911 and Mad TV and The Perfect Storm and all these huge movies. And we shot a movie in 8 days. And within 30 days from that phone call, we were shooting a movie. And we shot it, and that was the first movie I did, which was called This Is Meg. And that was the moment where I said, I don't care what other people think. I'm going to make this. And if I fail, I fail. I don't care. But I'm not going to not do this, because this wanting to impress other people or wanting to be accepted by others in the industry or by, you know, I always felt like I've been outside the party for my entire career, looking in to this great party going on. And I've snuck into the party a few times. I've been invited into the party a few times. But sooner or later, the bouncer finds me and pushes me right back out. And I realized, like, I don't want to go to that party anymore right now. I'm not going to go unless they invite me. And that's exactly what I've been doing. So with This Is Meg, that was the first conscious effort where I said, I don't care what happens to this movie. I wanted to succeed. Don't get me wrong. I wanted to succeed. I want people to like it. I would love for it to make some money so I can prove to my audience that it can be done. And it's exactly what happened with the movie. The movie went on to premiere at Cinequest, a world premiere at Cinequest, and played at a few other festivals. And then went on to, I sold it to Hulu, and then also sold it to around territories around the world. And it's made money. Not retirement money, but money nevertheless, and it was a successful movie. And I did not put any pressure on the art, which is what I think filmmakers make such a big mistake on, is they put so much pressure on the art that they're creating to do something for them. So if I'm going to make this movie, it has to blow me up. If I'm going to make this short film, it has to lead to me making a feature film. or get me an agent or get me a manager, or get me awards or whatever. You put that pressure on the art, and it's not fair to the art. But when you let the art breathe by itself, whatever that art might be, song, book, screenplay, whatever, it breathes by itself and it can grow and flourish. And that's, and I hope I'm not becoming a little too puff, you know, too touchy-feely here, but it's exactly what I did. And it worked. And I did the exact same thing again with my second movie. And then some, because that movie was shot in 4 days and we shot it at the Sundance Film Festival. And I had no idea what was going to come out when we shot it. I literally didn't even know if we had a movie when I came home with a hard drive. I was like, oh my God, we have a movie. And it was a really good one. I really enjoyed it. But I think that key to letting go and not putting the pressure on the art or on the work that you're doing really helped me out a lot. But that was the first time I made a conscious effort to just, I don't care what other people think.
Wow. Wow. That's such a powerful story. And I love how you laid that out there. You mentioned that, you know, a lot of creatives put pressure on the art to create for them. Do you think if creatives exercise that level of surrender, art would be so much more freer?
Oh, God, yes. You have no idea what it's like to be out on the edge, just dancing on a tightrope over the Grand Canyon with no net. That's what it's like making these movies. And it's wonderful. Because you know instinctively that if I fall, I know something's going to be there to catch me. I don't know why. I just do. And I kind of – because with On the Corner of Ego and Desire, I mean, I literally – I mean, I had a scriptment that I wrote that I had great actors who I'd never met before, by the way. So I'm working with three new actors, never met them before, in a strange land, which is Park City, Utah. I've been there a bunch of times, but, you know, it's not home. And I have, you know, the only people I really knew was my a friend of mine who came along to help and my DP. Other than that, I was surrounded by strangers trying to do something insanely crazy. And it was wonderful. Like, we all felt it. And everybody was so on board. Everybody was like, let's do this. And it was a wonderful creative. It's the most wonderful creative experience I have ever had. And it's addictive. I wish I could do it more and more and more. I'm choosing not to at the moment because I want to focus on other things I'm doing right now. But I can go out and make 3 or 4 features a year if I want to. I have nothing holding me back anymore because I've now figured out a pattern to make movies at a budget level where I can control and I could pay for it if I have to myself. And now I can go off and do it. It's a wonderful, wonderful freeing feeling.
I love the fact that you initially, when you thought about the Hollywood dream and, you know, you said that you felt like you were always outside the party and when you were invited in and all those sorts of things, it looks like you've kind of defined your own dream and you kind of have figured it out as you go along. And, you know, you just recently purchased a property. So it's not always as clear cut as, you know, go to university, get a job, buy a house. You kind of did it your own way. That's quite an accomplishment.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I was doing a talk the other night at a festival and I was telling the audience, I was like, look, you guys can't follow my path. My path is my path. You have to find your own. You could be inspired by mine as I've been inspired by many others, but you've got to find your own way to walk the walk. And that is, that's another big mistake I made growing up and being in the business. Whereas I used to devour biographies of filmmakers and I was just looking, so just feverishly for a path, a way to break in, a way to hack the system. I was looking. I was like, should I do it like Robert Rodriguez? Should I do it like Kevin Smith? Should I do it like Tarantino? Should I do it like Linkletter? Should I do it like Spike Lee? How do I get through this? You know, Edward Sanchez with Blair Witch. Like, how do we do this? And I kept trying to do what they did and failing. wonderfully failing, by the way, because I can't do what they did, because those moments in time were their moments and their paths. And none of the guys I just mentioned, none of them did it the exact same way. They all did it differently. They all did it their own way. So you have to discover your own way to make whatever you want happen. You can be inspired by other people's journeys. No question. I'm inspired by people all the time. I read all the time and hear these wonderful stories by other filmmakers. But you have to do you, which is the biggest thing I could say to people is you have to become comfortable in your own skin. You have to be able to be true to yourself, and you have to be brave enough to be yourself in whatever you do in life, because that is where the success lies. And if you do study all these other people who made it, you know, all the directors, all the actors, all the writers, these people are doing what they do best. They're being themselves. You know, actors like, I don't know, you know, famous Danny Trejo. Okay. We all know who Danny Trejo is. He's one of the most recognized faces around. Danny Trejo is not trying to be a leading man, though he actually was a leading man in Machete, but he's not trying to be Tom Cruise. He will never be Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise. We have a Tom Cruise. We have a Brad Pitt. But Danny's being Danny, and that's why he succeeds. He didn't come into the business trying to be a hot shot, you know, blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy, dyed his hair, tried to do everything right. No, he found out what he was good at. He found out who he was and sold it and put it out there, and that's why he's successful. So you study anyone that's any major success in this world, and they are being themselves. They're doing what they do, and they're being true to who they are at these high, high, high levels. You just, all of them, directors, writers, producers, all of them, they're all doing what they are. They're all being true to who they are.
This kind of reminds me of a quote from the book, The Seat of the Soul, from Gary Zukav. And I'm probably paraphrasing this quote very poorly, but essentially when the ego or the physical vehicle serves a soul, that is true empowerment. And it seems like everyone that you've mentioned there has done that exactly.
Yeah, without question. And I would love to talk a little bit about the ego because it is a favorite topic of mine.
Absolutely.
I love talking about the ego, and the ego loves to be heard.
The ego loves you talking about the ego, yeah.
Yes, even though I'm going to talk about it negatively, he still loves it. One of the reasons why I call my movie On the Corner of Ego and Desire is because there's so much ego controlling this business as a general statement and people in it. For 3 years, and I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, for 3 years, my wife and I opened up a olive oil and vinegar gourmet shop here in Los Angeles.
And this was olive oil and vinegar gourmet shop. I'm going to have to come visit your wife.
Well, yeah, well, we don't have one now. You'll see. You'll have to understand in a minute. So we opened this up because this was now 6-7 years ago when we opened it. And I was kind of really beaten down by the business. I was just tired, exhausted, and burnt. And I kind of, for a moment, left the business. Always had a foot in it because you can never really leave the business. But we opened up this store. And then from the store, we went to start doing farmers markets. And from farmers markets, we started doing, you know, 50,000-100,000 people events and, you know, traveling and doing all this kind of stuff for this company. And I got to tell you, the experience of going through that for 3 years was the most grueling 3 years of my entire life, physically, mentally, and spiritually. It beat me down in a way that I cannot explain to you. When I was done with that, my ego was decimated, just decimated. My body was too, for that matter. I was exhausted. I still have back problems from carrying all those damn olive oil bottles all over the place. But I would do sometimes 5 to 6 farmers markets a week personally. And it was brutal, brutal, brutal labor, just brutal. You know, it was just the most I've ever done. I was an editor, for God's sakes, and a director. Even the worst day of directing has nothing compared to a day in a farmer's market. It's just absolutely brutal. And the reason why we were having so much problems is because I feel that it was just not, I wasn't being true to who I was. That's just not for me. I thought it would be cool. I thought it was very romantic and all that stuff. But the good thing about that whole experience, as for my wife and me, because she changed a lot through the whole process as well, with me specifically, my ego was completely decimated to the point where I don't think I would have been able to make the films that I'm making now without going through that experience, without just completely being beaten down in a way that the ego could not recover from. And now, you know, don't get me wrong, I still have an ego that I deal with on a daily basis. Some parts of the ego are good, most of the parts are bad. But the experience really helped me out a lot to the point where I could let go. I could not care about what other people think, because before, the ego was completely controlling every aspect of my life in many ways. Just everything was about the ego, where now it's starting to go away, which is a gift that I wish I could give the entire planet, to let that ego go and kind of just fall away. Because once that happens, things start opening up. You become more in touch with who you are. You become more in touch spiritually with yourself, mentally with yourself, even physically with yourself. It's a wonderful experience. I wish and my goal in many ways is to spread that message to as many people as humanly possible that can hear it. Because if we can let go of a lot of the ego in this world, I think a lot of our problems would go away.
Absolutely. You've hit on so many gems there, Alex. But I guess when it comes to the ego, obviously the ego has a purpose. And you mentioned there's dark and light in the ego, the light being it's there to serve your security, but also to keep you very comfortable in your comfort zone. It doesn't want to move out of there, whereas your soul has other plans for you. You spoke a lot quite potently about, you know, how you found empowerment in being yourself and how important it is to find your thing, and success can be finding who you are and what you do, and just by being you. It might sound cliche, especially to the young people these days, to tell someone to be themselves. How do you reach them? Because you have a pretty cool gig of coaching people who are trying to make films. How do you reach people and how do you empower them, especially the young people, to be themselves?
Well, I think a lot of times, in today's world, they're growing up in a way that you and I didn't. I mean, social media is in many ways, I love this quote, like, social media brings people who are far away close and people who are close far away, and pushes people who are close far away. And it's such a great thing, because you're sitting around the table around with friends or family, and what are you doing? You're on social media. You're not interacting with the people who are literally in front of you. And I think that's a big, huge, huge monstrous problem. But I think what's going on with social media specifically and in this generation growing up in it is that they're learning that there is value being yourself and actually announcing it and publishing it out into the world with YouTube channels, social media accounts, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, but sometimes they create a fake persona to kind of put that out there. And there are those people, but the ones who are really succeeding are being extremely true to who they are. So I think there's a lot more education, a lot more opportunity for that, for young people to kind of figure it out now, because if you are out there being fake, generally speaking, people can smell that. When you're being genuine, people can also smell that. And that's something that nowadays we can figure out much quicker than we did before, because now you have instant reactions to things you do. You know, if I came out with Indie Film Hustle and started being someone who I'm not, it would have never worked. I've seen others try to do it and it didn't work. But I came out with Indie Film Hustle and was completely and totally authentic and raw and vulnerable and in your face, because that's who I am. And within those first 3 months, my podcast became the number one filmmaking podcast on iTunes. That doesn't happen all the time. It was because of my authenticity. And I think young people will figure that out faster than our generation did. But it will take time.
Having what you said about social media and the internet, one thing I love, the positive of the internet is, and I say this to my little niece all the time, is when I'm gone and you have your children, they'll be able to know what your auntie was like because they can just listen to me or they can watch me on a video, whereas I have no idea what my great-grandparents were like other than photos, which is only like a couple around. When you leave this earth, what would you like your legacy to be?
Oh, man, that's a heavy question.
You wanted to go deep, Alex.
You know, I think, well, first of all, I think legacy is a construct of the ego. So for that, I don't really care. What I like to do while I'm here is to spread as much information and empowerment to people to empower themselves, tools I hopefully will be able to create to help people around the world empower themselves to get themselves out of wherever they are in the world, whether that be creatives or others in other avenues of their life, to be able to get them out of where they are and leave that message behind that it is in your power to change things. You can, you are the pilot of your plane. The world might throw things at you, but how you deal with those things, how you maneuver through those things is in your power. And that's the message I want to put out there into the world. And that's something I would like to leave behind, whether it be through what I'm doing currently now, what I'll be doing in the next 10 years and the next 20 years. But that's what I would like to leave behind. I really could care less about my legacy. I could really care less about what, you know, my name or any of that stuff left behind, because I always tell people, and this is something I always say, I'm like, you know what? In 100,000 years, no one's going to remember any of us. No one's going to remember Shakespeare. No one's going to remember any of the greats of any world, because chances are we'll either have killed ourselves by that time. Everything will have been destroyed. The planet is gone. An asteroid hit us. Or we've left somehow. And that kind of makes things – that opens things up a lot for me personally, because you have to think about – I mean, you have to think about it. Recorded history is really 4,000 years? That's recorded history. This planet is billions of years old. It's nothing. And it's ego that thinks, how important am I? How important am I? I have to leave a legacy behind. Where there's no guarantee in the next 10,000 years, let alone 100 or 500,000 years, any of this is going to be left behind. So I have to look at it that way. And it makes me more comfortable knowing that, because that means to me that I have to do whatever I want to do now. I have to be true to who I am, because we are only on this planet for a short time. We're here if we take care of ourselves 100 years, 120 years probably, hopefully for our generation, we'll be in that world. But we'll see. We'll see how the whole world turns out. It's not looking good right now, but I do have hope. But that's the legacy, is to not leave a legacy and hopefully help as many people as I can while I'm on this planet. And then hopefully my work and my messages will hold for years to come and hopefully help people far after I'm gone. That's the kind of legacy, I guess, if you want to say legacy, I leave behind. But I could care less. It could be anonymous for all I care. It doesn't matter.
Wow. Well, Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's like a super soul session with you.
Well, you ask good questions. You ask great questions.
Thank you very much, Alex. Well, you know, I think this is only like one gazillionth of the conversation. We've just opened up a Pandora's box. So I'll definitely have to have you back on for Saturday brunch, and we'll have to lock in another brunch time.
Absolutely. Anytime. I love talking to you, Jenny. You know that.
Thank you, Alex. The Jenny Show.
Only things are going on. Hi, this is Brooke Devard from Naked Beauty. Are you tired of feeling housebound? I sure am. Break free with the new Unbound Cordless Auto Curler from Conair. It's a high-performance auto curler that's rechargeable and gives you up to 60 minutes of cord-free runtime. Just think of all of the incredible hair looks you can create in 60 minutes, unbound, away from your wall. Don't get tied down by cords. Love your look. Live unbound. Check it out at Conair.com and search Unbound.